Okay, we resume our meeting and we're going to talk about the materiality preference statement. Floor to Ana Maria.
Yes, is it? Okay, we are now looking at paper 11, and the paper presents two sweep issues that arose during the drafting process of the materiality practice statement, and both issues refer to the guidance on covenant in the draft practice statement. So before going into detail, just a quick step back to recap where we are in the process. So in December last year, we received permission to start the balloting process of the final practice statement. In March this year, we sent for review a preliminary draft of the practice statement to the board, to the interpretation committee, and to a number of external parties. And in this draft included a section on covenants. This section addressed two main concerns. The first one is how an entity assesses the materiality of information about covenant, and this is the section. This section is related to the issue number one in the paper. The second concern addressed by the draft practice statement is whether an entity is influenced by the existence of a covenant when making materiality judgment on other information in the financial statements. And this subsection is related to the issue number two in the paper. And if it's okay for you, we will start presenting issue number two. So from page six of the paper, paragraph 17 to 43. So what the draft practice statement states is that since covenant terms are often defined on the basis of information in IFRS financial statement, an entity makes materiality judgment about this information without being influenced by the existence of the covenant. So during the external review process, some parties observe that this guidance is inconsistent with the auditing guidance, so the international standards on auditing, and also with some security regulation guidance. And in particular, according to these guidance, the effect on the compliance with debt covenant might lead an entity to evaluate an error, even a very small error and a trivial error, as material. And a related concern raised is that guidance conflicting with existing local law and regulation might be seen as a change or as a new interpretation of existing requirements in IFRS standard, which will be contrary to the nature of the practice statement, which is not supposed to change existing requirements or to introduce any new interpretation of existing requirements. So we decided to ask the board to confirm its decision, and in the paper we provided three possible alternatives the board could choose from. So alternative A is to retain the guidance on the impact of covenant on materiality assessment, which is actually a couple of paragraphs plus an example in the draft practice statement. But reminding entity that local laws and regulation might require an entity to consider compliance with debt covenant when assessing the materiality of an error, and this is alternative A. Alternative B is to remove this guidance, so these two paragraphs and the example from the draft practice statement, retaining the first subsection related to covenant, so how an entity assesses the materiality of information about covenant. And alternative C is to replace the guidance in those paragraphs with an alternative guidance, for example, guidance stating that materiality judgment should be influenced by the existence of a covenant. So the paper provides pros and cons of each alternative, and I won't go into detail. I will just illustrate the reason why we decided to provide a staff recommendation and what our staff recommendation is. So to make our decision, we refer back to the objective of the practice statement. And the practice statement should provide a useful tool to help entities making materiality judgment, but without changing or introducing any new requirements in IFRS standard. And an additional objective is to also provide a useful reference point for discussion between the entity, its auditor, and regulator, and with the aim of facilitating those discussions. So if we retain the existing guidance in the practice statement, so alternative A, so in a document which is not supposed to change any requirements or provide any new interpretation, we might create confusion among all parties involved in financial reporting. And we're worried that this confusion could risk undermining the entire practice statement and reduce the effectiveness of the document. So this leaves us with just alternative B and alternative C, but we also believe that replacing the proposed guidance in the draft practice statement with an alternative guidance is not advisable either, because the board risks suggesting an endless reassessment on the of the materiality judgment that might lead to a situation where all figures in the financial statement might become material the closer an entity gets to a covenant breach. So we recommend alternative B, which is to remove the guidance about the impact on covenant or materiality judgment, but retaining the guidance on how to assess the materiality of information about covenant, which is the first subsection. And our question on page 12 is just ask you whether you agree with our recommendation or not.
Do we agree that less is more? Hossard.
Thank you. You dealt with the two issues in your presentation,
yes.
So I'm quickly telling you that I agree with your first recommendation. I may be a bit longer on the second issue, but I'm trying to be short nevertheless. In short, I support alternative I, which is to retain the guidance, and I have a number of reasons for that. Last month, we considered the possibility of updating ICE 8 in order to facilitate agenda decisions of the IFREC to trigger changes. And in all the discussion, it was highlighted that even though the requirements didn't change, new information being provided in a non-unauthoritative manner could shed new light on how IFRS should be applied. So we have numerous examples already when we have in our environment non-authoritative guidance that sheds new light on how IFRS should be applied without the requirements changing, and they may trigger changes in practice. So I don't think this practice statement is in any way a different animal from that perspective. The second point is that if this practice statement was not meant to change behaviors, we would have wasted a lot of time preparing for it. So unless it is able to trigger changes, we have missed our objective. So when the reason for your recommendation is that, in fact, it may trigger changes, in fact, to me, that's part of the objective. So it would not be a reason for not doing it. Then I have supplementary reasons. I think when the paper refers to a guidance by the SEC guidance is relevant to the IFRS environment to only a subset of entities, and largely entities that have chosen to subject themselves to the SEC requirements, whereas IFRS is widely adopted, as we know, by many people who are not entities that are not listed under the SEC requirements. And I don't see why we would prevent these people, these companies, from relying on a more extensive guidance. I think also that it is the primary responsibility of the standard setter to set this kind of guidance that affects the way financial statements are prepared. And in fact, in Europe, not very long ago, ESMA consulted on a possible guidance on materiality, and stakeholders responded, that's not your job, should be the job of the ISB. So you have an expectation in Europe that this comes from the ISB as being done. So these are the reasons why. I have, in a way, the same argument as you have in your recommendation to support the other alternative. And among the two other alternatives, I fully agree with you that to me, alternative C would just not be acceptable at all.
Stephen?
So I essentially agree with Francois. I think certainly shouldn't do C. I think the right answer is A, and I think we went through all the process, got to the right place. My only reservation maybe is, you know, are we creating problems for ourselves and therefore maybe we should go to B? So I've got a question for you. Does anybody else say the same thing as the SEC? So lots of other regulators around the world. Who else says the same thing?
The international standards on auditing also is not just security regulation. So the guidance they are providing is similar to the SEC. So they view as the compliance with that covenant as being a qualitative factor you need to take into consideration when you assess the materiality of an error. So it's not just security regulator, it's also the auditing guidance that says exactly the same.
But auditing guidance is not accounting standards. Doing a different thing, isn't it? Why should it necessarily be consistent with what we say for IFRS?
Well, we're not saying we need to be consistent with the auditing guidance. It's not that the reason we are suggesting alternative B. The reason we are suggesting alternative B is that we view this conflict as a signal that maybe we are really introducing something new, some new interpretation of IFRS standard. And if we saw this as a signal, we cannot ignore it, and probably the practice statement is not the best document to deal with this issue. And if we retain the guidance in the practice statement, we won't help preparers, because we won't stop discussion between preparers and auditor or preparers and regulator, because actually it's a non-mandatory document. So regulators and auditor might just say, okay, but our guidance prevails, so please do what we are asking you.
But if we did B, would we then expose some amendment to the practice statement and go through some process again? Because it seems like a massive hole then in the practice statement.
Well, if we choose B, so if we remove this guideline, we save ourselves the possibility to probably propose this guidance in another form. So not in the practice statement, because, okay, it's not within the boundary of the practice statement to deal with this issue, but we save ourselves the possibility if we believe that this guidance is needed, if we believe that this guidance is important, we might propose a new document, a mandatory document.
Exposure draft didn't include these words, so did it? So it's not that we're removing something that the world has commented on before. This has come in subsequent. Correct?
That's correct.
Yeah, but it has come subsequently because the commentators have said that what was exposed was not really helping them. So when we have responded positively to providing helpful supplements, should not be removed.
Well, I suggested it should be clarified, but I'm not sure they said necessarily as we did it. I don't remember.
Yeah.
But
I think part of the problem here is that the exposure draft actually included guidance that suggested
Exactly the
opposite to where this guidance now is.
Can I ask a stupid, possibly a very stupid question? Now, so we introduced this guidance because we were afraid that people would get into this loop, constant reassessment of the numbers. But how plausible is that in practice? Isn't it plausible that if a company is close to breaking a covenant, that it is aware of that while it is preparing its statements? I couldn't believe that a company that is close to the edge, that it is not aware of the situation. And if that is the case in 90% of the cases, wouldn't they already automatically be looking with more focus to those numbers? And in practice apply perhaps a lower threshold for materiality. So is there a problem? I really wonder if there's a problem.
But probably this is true in the majority of cases, not in all cases. For instance, in the example we included in the in the draft practice statement. So instead of talking about an error which trigger the compliance with the covenants, we were proposing an example related to the setting a capitalization threshold. And sometimes you set your capitalization threshold, well, starting from January the 1st, and you keep this capitalization threshold for the entire reporting period, and you don't necessarily know how close you are to breach a covenant at the beginning of your reporting period.
Martin,
I'm really in favor to remove that, the second issue, because I think it is not good if we are in conflict with SEC guidelines and also auditors' guidelines, and I think we create problems for preparers. What should they do in this situation? So I could remove it. Also, I think on the first issue, man, I was from the beginning not in favor of including that, because I think also is a kind of, I think, fact and circumstances which kind of this covenants breaches has to be disclosed, because they are material or not, and it's not only kind of, is it remote possibility, yes or no. I think that is my position from the beginning, and when we're removing the second, which I think is the most more, I think, important thing, then we should also remove the first thing, I think, because also I think it is a kind of bright line, which I think if it is a kind of really big event, which could really very, very material influence, I think it is not this bright line between remote and not remote, I think, is also difficult to apply, and I think it is more judgment thing. And as I said already, I think in earlier discussion, I think this overall practice statement is to address really more this kind of change in behavior of more material disclosure and removing non-material stuff. And I don't know, from the beginning, I think we didn't have this covenant. It came in, I think, after some comments. And if we create more problems than we solve, I think it should not be in a practice statement. That is what I think. So remove both, that would be my
suggestion.
Mary?
On the second issue, I really want to advocate alternative B, which is the removal. Like others, I think C and going to C, even though C is what we exposed in the exposure draft, I think the whole iterative process of discussion and comments that we've had back says to me that this is an issue in which there is some diversity in view about what IFRS should say. And my biggest concern is that the drafting and finalization of the practice statement is not the right vehicle for resolving this. I hear Francoise's concerns about the SEC kind of having jurisdiction over only a limited population, and I agree that the SEC generic view on materiality is not a permanent barrier to any conclusion that we want to make when we, you know, if we deliberate the issue head on, rather than as a byproduct of our practice statement. And do it in a way that engages everybody, knowing that it's an authoritative decision about, you know, this aspect of qualitative materiality consideration. So I don't see it as a permanent barrier. I just come back to saying, given that we proposed A, and then in finalizing we want to flip to B, and we didn't get comments on, given that we proposed 1 and we want to flip to 2, I think rather than either flipping back to 1 or nailing down 2, we should take it out and say, let's think about how significant this issue is and whether or not we should add a limited scope project to resolve this issue, when we can say to everybody, pay attention, you better get involved. This is going to be authoritative, rather than don't worry about this if you don't want to. It's a non-mandatory practice statement, and we didn't consult on it. So I say B for now, and then decide what kind of priority to fix it.
Gary.
I disagree with the staff's recommendation, and I think we should go with alternative A. Just a few comments, Hans, sort of reacting to your earlier comment about don't companies know these things are coming. I never entire life lived through a breach, but I lived through hitting thresholds. It went from investment grade to non-investment grade. It got numeric numbers. It's not a breach, but it, you know, puts in different disclosures, different interest rate things. So a lot of analogy. Let me show you. I won't, it's a big world. You can't say no one doesn't know, but most people know if you're starting to approach these things. They don't. They tend to be a gradual trend towards it. You see it coming. You've got your budgeting. You've got your forecasting period. So it's hard to envision that, you know, other than a small percentage of times that you don't see it coming in the institute discussions with your bank or whoever the lending, you know, people are. The other thing, when you breach, doesn't mean you're writing a check the next day, typically. It means you're, you engage in a discussion with the lender about what are we going to do about it, whether it's a new interest rate or more collateral, whatever, you know, reduce capital spending. I mean, that's what happens, I think, in practice most of the time. So maybe if you're, you know, D investment grade and they're looking for any excuse to get in priority money, fine. But most of the time, we're not that. It seems a going concern circumstance. So I find it hard to think that this is would be a bolt out of the blue and a surprise all that often. I think when I looked through the I agree with...
If I may interject, Gary, that was precisely my point.
Yeah, that was your point. You see it coming.
You see it coming. Well, so if you see it coming and you don't first have to do all your numbers, would you... And you're close to the threshold, and even though it will not immediately mean the end of the world, but it is a significant event, wouldn't almost automatically your focus on materiality be a bit more intense than
Yes, it would, but not necessarily perhaps in the context of what we're talking about in this room. The first thing we do, we would call the people at your lending institutions and you would talk to them. I think that's the first thing that you would do and see what you can work out. But let me only answer your second question, you know, as I go through why I don't like B or C. You know, Stephen and Francois said most of the reasoning, so I will try not to repeat too much of it, but I think this is primarily between us and I'll call the securities regulators. I don't think the auditors, I think their job is to attest against the accounting standards. So they're entitled to have an opinion, but I don't think auditing standards should drive where we go. Purpose of the practice statement, and it's in paragraph one, is to give guidance to preparers on how to apply materiality. That's its stated purpose. So giving no guidance on something we've heatedly discussed and exposed and so on seems to be just the wrong answer. We should give guidance. Now, we have two choices here. Maybe there's multiple other choices, but I think what we exposed the first time, which is, I think, alternative C, it's not like we haven't changed, you know, as a result of exposure and feedback and consultation. It's not like we've never changed exposed positions before. So I'm not really driven by the concern to re-expose it. In fact, I think A is perhaps more consistent with IFRS because we're allowed to have reasonable approximations and estimates and so on in our standards. And we've said materiality is the statements as a whole and so on. But put that aside, is I think the consequences of C, and I think we talked about it, the big companies number gets smaller and smaller. If we went with C, I think you'd probably have to do, but the staff would have to bring more work back. What does a small number of materiality mean? Does it mean an error? Does it mean have to revisit the reasonableness of estimates and judgments? Does it revisit your accounting policies? Does it automatically mean you go to the most conservative answer? I mean, the example we've got here, I like its simplicity, you know, a capitalization threshold. But that's basically a bookkeeping convention. So you reopen all your bookkeeping conventions, and big companies got dozens of how you close the books. You know, you used a fixed asset threshold as an example, but there's plenty of other ones that are just ordinary closing the books that are shortcuts and, you know, working rules and assumptions and so on. So I think it's a whole lot more than just say the number gets small. Well, what number? I appreciate a deliberate error, but then what about the reasonableness of accounting policies? Well, I don't think C is a workable answer. I think A is the right answer. There's one number of materiality. If you accept and negotiate on contract with a preparer that these numbers will be computed in accordance with IFRS standards, you accept the entire body of IFRS work that goes with it. And why do you get sort of a piecemeal approach to one particular measure and not the others?
Tom?
You seem to be getting a nice diversity on this issue. So go to the second one. Observe.
You want C, Tom?
What?
You want C?
Make it even more diverse.
Yes.
Oh, no. I think I agree with the staff after having looked at this. I think for about three or four reasons. I'm sort of just rereading the basis, and I think in the plan basis, when we said sort of, I think that it overstated the case to some degree. So for example, it says things like the preparation of information as the covenant assessed would create a circular assessment. Circular is a bit pejorative any time you use the term. I think a reciprocal, it's more of a reciprocal process. You sort of go and you sort of take a quick peek and where would this move it, and then you go back and then you flip. And probably you oscillate maybe three times at most. It's not like you're caught in a horrible circle. I think we do a lot of decisions like that where you are aware of the covenants out there. You do a quick mental calculation. You don't have to redesign your whole systems to say, is this going to be really close or not? And I think with respect to the SEC and the auditors, I don't think we should be driven by either, but I think we should be aware of them. The SEC is an important constituent, and putting firms where they're struggling with an SEC reg and ours, unless we have a really compelling case, I'm a little bit reluctant to do it. I'm also reluctant to put people in a position, again, with their auditors, where the auditors are apparently obliged to think about this. And then when I go back to the very definition of materiality and we talk about the user, would this influence the user? Yeah, in a lot of cases, and again, I think Gary makes some excellent points. Sometimes you breach a covenant and you just go back and you tidy up the negotiations, you rewrite it, off you go. Sometimes you don't. And so that's part of the context. And I actually think paragraphs 44 to 51 that talk about using the context and thinking about what would really matter to a user is probably fine if we drop those paragraphs. We might want to buttress them. When we talk about a context, we talk about mostly macroeconomic issues. I'm not sure if it's okay to talk about firm-specific issues. But what really bothers me in the way we did this is it's an outright prohibition from considering. You know, you will do this without considering. And if you drop the paragraphs, it leaves open some judgment to basically go back to paragraphs 44 to 51 and pose the standard question, would a user be influenced or not? And so I actually pretty sympathetic. In particular, I think kind of what Mary said, it's not clear that we have it right. We ought not to be putting in a prohibition on this at this time. I think just letting it work and developing, taking another look at 44 to 51 seems a safer route without putting people offside their auditors and things.
I agree with that, especially because preparers would take it into account for the reasons we just discussed. Sue?
It's a difficult one. I think on balance, I'm with the staff recommendation, alternative B, for a couple of reasons. Firstly, it's not what we exposed, and I completely agree with Gary that in itself isn't a reason not to do it, because otherwise we'd never finish anything, because we'd have to be re-exposing perpetually, because we never finalise exactly as we expose. But I think where we expose something and then we sort of propose something which is almost the opposite, we need to be a little bit more cautious. And if I remember looking at the comments we got on the draft document, it wasn't only the regulators, there were lots of people asking questions about what the possible consequences were of what people might read, and particularly to the example, which made me cautious. The other reason why I think I'm cautious and why I think I'm sort of with Mary in terms of not now, not in a non-authoritative document is, if we think about what the sort of objective of this was and the way that we know that it's going to need to work in practice, we're publishing a document which is non-authoritative, which we're hoping is going to help change behaviour in the market. So certainly we're looking for change, as Francoise rightly said, but for this to work, we really need a group of people to sort of almost work in partnership or as part of an environment. So we're going to need a relationship that works between preparers, auditors and regulators. And if we start off with a document where we know there will be at least some regulators who are going to say, well, we don't agree with that document, therefore you've immediately got tension between the preparers and the regulators, I think it's going to be harder to see how this document will be effective in achieving the change that we're hoping that it's going to achieve. So I think the more that this document is something that the regulators and auditors and others can look at it and say, yeah, I get that why they're saying that and I sort of agree with the philosophy in here, the more constructive the debate's going to be with the people in the system, and I think it's just going to go off with a better start. And so I think the document overall is better served by removing a clear point of tension in the document.
Darrell.
I think I might be maintaining the diversity even amongst the Scots. So I struggled with this one as in a lot of the things that Sue's spoken about. On the face of it, if I look at what's particularly in paragraph 20 of the document, where we explain some of the rationale of how we got to where we are, and in particular the fact that if somebody has accepted that they're going to base their covenants on IFRS numbers, then what they're expecting is IFRS numbers, and IFRS numbers come with the materiality considerations. So it seems to me there's a logical flow. It makes absolute sense. I think we were right where we were. I also agree with some of the comments made by others that when we released this, we expected changes in behavior. That was the intention when we proposed this. We expected changes in behavior, and those changes in behavior weren't just preparers. We were specifically targeting changes in behavior amongst regulators and auditors. So that was a part of the thought process that went into it. So it seems like challenging some of the assumptions that are part of the inherent system was part of the reason why we went about doing this. So I think I'd probably lean closer to sticking with where we were. That said, I think the consideration I found particularly difficult is to release a document into a space where we expect that people are going to immediately refute some of the conclusions is a difficult space. And the question that I kind of left myself with at the end here is whether we think, as a consequence of this document entering the public space, something like, what is it, Statement 450, which I think is the audit document, would be changed as a consequence to better reflect what we believe the outcome is. So I sort of struggled with those two sides of things, but I think on balance, I'm probably leaning towards A, to staying where we are.
Yeah, I was wondering, listening to all this, two things. First of all, I wonder whether the difficulty with the auditing standard is just not a bit overmade, because basically it seems to be possibly, I don't know auditing standards myself, but evaluation of misstatements identified during the audit is the title. So it's really, auditors have to exercise judgment. There is nothing mandatory there. And the existence of a debt covenant may make a misstatement material, when without the existence of a debt covenant, the misstatement would not be material. And that's, in a way, a very relevant question to ask. When you consider a misstatement, the issue we are discussing is whether, when you set your materiality thresholds for whatever transactions you account for, whether you should take into consideration the existence of debt covenant. So I think the scope of the two issues are widely different. The issue. The point I wanted to make on top of this is, I was wondering whether we could not get some form of consensus, if we really all over the place, on an alternative D. because I'm sensitive to the arguments that put into evidence that this is coming without having been exposed specifically, and I mean, I could agree to an alternative D if we were going to consider this further. I mean, I have not thought of, I mean, you know, it's coming to my mind right now, so I have not thought of how it could be done. But I would not want this to be curtailed. So I can understand that good reasons why it would be delayed but not abandoned. And also I wanted, in fact, Daval made the point. I think it's also these, I'm not sure they would read it, but in case they would have an interest in that, I mean, lenders, I think, would be being made aware that the existence of debt covenants does not have a role to play into how materiality thresholds are made. It's a good information for them. Exactly as Daryl has pointed out. Silence is not so helpful.
Doug?
Thank you. I basically agree with the idea written in the draft, but I don't think the practice statement is the right place to expose, I mean, to publish. Because the purpose of the practice statement is to change the behavior. In this sense, it's okay. However, when it comes to this covenant specific issue, IWSB has a specific, you know, regulation or rules to audit. So therefore, we know there is an obvious contract conflict with the audit procedure. So therefore, if we provide the practice statement, it only creates confusion rather than clarification. So therefore, I don't think it's the right place to put it in a practice statement, which is non-authoritative. If we were to provide this idea, this should be more authoritative document so that the IWSB can follow, or SEC, even SEC can follow. So then we need a different due process rather than practice statement. So in this sense, I think
the process is the same.
Yeah, the due process is the same, but the title of the statement is different.
Yeah.
And actually, and that this may contain some conceptual issue, although practically, as Hans pointed out, it's the same, but conceptually, whether or not the financial statement is more, you know, solid one, and make a judgment without considering any covenants or, you know, kind of nuisance, just make a judgment. And then consider the covenants later. That's what we are saying, and I think this is right. And that this is the right way we move forward. So if that is the case, we could put it even in the POD, a principle of disclosure, because it's still open. We could bring it the idea of this kind of materiality judgment into POD after the deliberation, so that we can ask constituents whether our concept is basically right or not. And if we can get the consent from the constituents, then we can change the standard if necessary. And then auditor has to follow that idea. Then it wouldn't give any confusion. So that is the right way we should move forward. So therefore, I agree with the staff's recommendation going to be. Having said that, I agree with Martin as well. I think going to B means to remove only 85 and 86. I don't think it is a good solution, because if we leave 81 to 84, so that is imperfect. I think to some extent there are some people who disagree with the conclusion of paragraph 84, because 84 says, you know, you have to consider likelihood and consequences. But all these consequences and the likelihood are so judgmental. And it closely related to the paragraph 85 and the 86 as well. So therefore, paragraph 84 and 85-86 is not really separable, because constituents has to make a comprehensive judgment whether the covenant issue is material or not, whether they have to change that number or not. So therefore, just simply leaving 84 and the remove 85-86 is not really a good way. If we were to remove this idea, I think we should remove our total section of covenants, and then we should come back in the POD or somewhere else.
Maru?
I don't know how helpful it would be at this stage, but I struggle very much with this. I read many times, I would say, paragraphs 85 and 86. And my reaction in reading them is that I would apply exactly what is written here if I didn't have this written down. So I would expect someone to apply exactly this if this was not written. Then I thought about...
And if it's written, then you do the opposite?
No. That was... I would be surprised to hear someone apply differently. Because if I read only 85, if you allow me, covenant terms are often defined on the basis of other information in IFRS statement. This is not new. This, we are just clarifying. An entity makes materiality judgment about this other information, I'm talking about IFRS numbers, without being influenced by the evidence existence of covenant. Of course, I think this is natural. Otherwise, we are subjecting all IFRS literature to the existence of covenant. That makes no sense. Mm. So, and then I read again and again, seeing what is the matter here. And then, although sympathetic to arguments that, well, regulators and auditors have these, when it comes to regulators, I wouldn't put that much weight on the existence of SEC regulation. I think we've mentioned many, many times that we are not able to consider all regulatory schemes or regulatory environments in developing our regulation. This is one thing. When it comes to auditors, although acknowledging that ISA might consider other aspects, I don't think they have the same objective at the end of the day. Materiality for auditors consider many other aspects, including the effect, the potential effect in the auditing risk. So I think it's a little bit different. And then I went to the rest of the paragraphs that talk about covenants. And I said, well, that makes no sense to provide only 81 to 84 and then suddenly disappear with the portion that apparently is more educational than the other. Then consider everything that was in the paper, and I had a quick chat with staff as well. I was really divided on how to follow this. And on balance, at the end of the day, I think the best way for us is to keep going in alternative A. I think this is the one that makes sense. If by chance we decided not to go to A, I think we should consider deleting everything in the covenant session and then consider in another project.
All or nothing with the
preference.
Mary.
Just coming back on a point that a couple people have raised about, we should be able to change our minds between exposure draft and final as part of our deliberative process. I think that normally is true, but it just struck me that the thing that's different about this is not just because it's non-authoritative, but because we've said we aren't changing any requirements of IFRS. And so if we exposed thing one and we change our mind about what the current requirements of IFRS are between exposure and final, I think we are providing new guidance about what the current requirements are. So it, to me, this document is an exception to the norm about our ability to change our minds between exposure and final in terms of a reading of what the current requirements are. And since our exposure draft had exactly the opposite, I think that that itself says that there's some uncertainty about how IFRS should be read. So it's the point about, can we change our mind? We always change our minds on some issues. I think that this is a slightly different circumstance.
Yeah. That's a good point.
Gary? Just a few build-on thoughts. I'm still in the position we should go with A as proposed and in the exposure draft, or I guess, or the current draft of the document, I guess, is a little more accurate. Just a few thoughts. First of all, I think is, besides giving guidance to repairers, and I think several people had said, one of the objectives is to change behavior, and behavior does change slowly over time. Mm-hmm. If we don't, assuming, we think we've got the right answer in A, ignoring, the larger process around it, if we don't express it, I mean, when would you express it? I mean, I think by might not even get to anything, might not get the POD, might get to another standard. So I think we're entitled to an opinion. If we want to change behavior, you got to express that opinion in some vehicle. This is as convenient and timely as a communication vehicles we've got. I think if we don't go forward and say something, I think what you really have done is you've kind of, if by default, if nothing else, you've institutionalized the current behavior, which numbers can get very small, under alternative C. And I don't think that's what we think is the right answer either. I think we're doing a little bit of overlapping audit materiality and financial reporting materiality as well. I think they're different things. I mean, audit scope, audit measures of materiality, and so on are different than closing your books type materiality. I would say it push comes to shove. If auditors believe you've violated a covenant for whatever reason, they're not going to give you an opinion. So I think the audit process wins, at the end of the day, if it's clear cut or something. So I'm not too worried, actually, about that. I think, granted, the world's loaded with gray areas and stuff, and reasonable people can reasonably differ, but push comes to shove, I think, in general, if you want a clean audit opinion, chances are you're going to have to convince the auditor you're right. So I'm not that worried about the order of cars. The regulatory requirements, I think, is a different beast, but again, part of the goal is to change, among other things, regulatory behavior. I think the document is giving guidance in a number of areas. If we're not giving guidance, then why are we issuing it? I mean, it's one thing to compile a bunch of things you've got in the winter cover, that's useful, but everything we write should be given guidance in some way or another. I think A is more consistent with IFRS, requirements, as Amaro pointed out, in first sentences of paragraph 85. So for all those reasons, I'm still sticking with A is the right way to go forward.
Steph probably now regrets that they ever started talking about covenants to begin with.
I mean, if you hadn't done that,
it's all your fault.
No, would it have make the document a lot less valuable? Really?
You shouldn't be so responsive to comments we receive, Steph. I was going to ask Gary a question.
Sue.
Gary, I was going to ask you a question, and this is a genuine question, not a provocative question. But you talked about us trying to, I can't remember the words you used, but I think to sort of effect change, and I guess I took from that show leadership. So if we think this is right, then it needs to start somewhere. And I completely agree with you, and I think Francoise made the same point, that for me the whole audit materiality is a secondary thing. It's nothing really to do with what we're talking about, but what worries me more is what the regulators think.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing that I've heard from the regulators so far would suggest that they've sort of said, oh, actually, you've got a fair point, maybe we should reconsider our guidance. I think the sense I've got is they think that they're probably right and we're missing the point. And so I don't have much expectation.
Is it just the SEC?
I'm not sure it is just the SEC.
Do we know?
We are aware just of the SEC. There might be other security
but regulations. But we don't know.
But my only point, Francoise, I see you immediately put your card up, is I don't think we can assume that they're going to think, oh, this is a great idea, therefore we're going to change our requirements. And if we do have a situation where the regulators disagree, and they've got authoritative guidance they can impose on people, and we've made an observation which is the opposite in a non-authoritative document, do you think we're really going to be able to effect change?
And,
or is this going to cause arguments?
Yeah. Well, it's something, you know, change starts at the first step, I think, and someone's got to initiate it. I mean, if the auditing profession or the regulatory profession or any other profession is happy with where they are, it's not likely they're going to start the change process. I would also point out I'm willing to learn more, but this in the SEC, this isn't a staff accounting bulletin. This is not an official action of the SEC. Now, not to say the staff's opinion doesn't count, but it is not a securities regulation. It's a staff bulletin, and it's SAB 99, from 1999. So it is not, I don't believe it's been exposed, and it's certainly not authoritative, in the regulatory sense of the word. So still something we, as US preparers, we certainly look to it, and anything else the staff writes, but let's, that's where it stands legally. And
Gary is just so happy to finally he can get cross with the SEC.
No.
Followed their rules for so long.
Staff not seven, it was self as a change,
Martin.
And I agree with Gary that we should give guidance. But if this guidance is in conflict with, I think, what auditors think and what the SEC think, I think the practice statement is not the right place. Then we should give authoritative guidance, because when I would, if I would be in CFO of a company and sitting in an audit committee and have prepared my financial statements based on our guidance, and then the auditors say, but it's not in line with our guidance, and especially it's not with the SEC guidance, how stupid is that? And what should be the answer then from the CFO, and saying, okay, but this was issued by the ISB in a practice statement. The audit says, what is the kind of practice statement? I never heard this. Is it authoritative guidance?
No. Get your water nurse.
It's a bit funny, but I agree that we should do something. But as Tuck said, then in authoritative guidance and not in a practice statement. That is what I think.
Isn't that just going to compound the problem?
No, that is because then I think the auditors have to follow. The auditor cannot have different rules. And then the SEC has also to follow, because if they want to have it in IFRS compliance, if it's, I think that is then the right way.
But I think we've put in here multiple places that this is always subject to local laws, regulations, etc. I mean, if so we've already sort of acknowledged the superior position vis-a-vis this.
Another example, it can't be a big issue for a company to be in a break of this kind of covenants. And then the CEO, the CFO has decided, do I follow this practice statement or do I follow SEC? What do I do? I think we create conflicts which are not solvable by companies. And therefore we should.
And again, I think in practice, it's sourced itself by the fact that when a company is in such a position, it will be much more attentive and will probably in practice have a lower threshold. I don't see what the problem is, to tell you the truth. Tom.
So just reiterate a little bit. I think in particular, if we're providing guidance, we have to be sure it's right and better if it's not in conflict. And the thing here is, because we've made it absolute, notice if you remove them, you go to a neutral position. You don't say you must now take into account covenants. Right now we're saying you must not take into account covenants. And when I look at the basic definition of material, it's material if it could influence the decisions of users.
Yeah.
So this requires some judgment, and which is why I'm not comfortable with the absolute prohibition. I am not suggesting that we bounce all the way to the other side, and whether we could write something, that would suggest that I think in principle and normally you would not want to start invoking this all the time. However, if you're sitting in a position where it's likely to matter and it's likely to influence in the judgments, which is why I think you go back and look at 44 to 51 and think carefully about whether those could be expanded. But I do want to sort of stress that I think by removal, we are not sort of saying go one way entirely. And then I think that goes back again, I think, to Mary's thing is if we're going to provide guidance, especially in conflict, we better be very certain.
Daryl, François, and then Leah. So I wouldn't want to repeat, I think, what's been before. So the thing I perhaps emphasize is the last discussion we had here about what regulators really do require. So the first thing is that regulators always have the ability to be stricter than our standards. So that's a given. If they want to actually tighten up materiality, they can tighten up materiality on particular issues. But I think the problem is we seem to be getting ourselves into making a decision based on what we think most...
You're talking just about materiality, right?
They can also ask for additional disclosures if they want additional disclosures. So there's other areas where regulators can define that you go beyond what the standards require in a particular aspect. So I don't find that necessarily a persuasive argument. I am concerned now that we're sort of assuming that because the SEC requires it, therefore there must be a broader requirement for it, and I think that's the second thing that worries me. The third one is to bear in mind that there are some companies that live round about their covenant levels for very long periods of time. So as much as you might be approaching it, once you've approached it, you might be there for a long time. So what we're suggesting here may imply that you have a lower level of materiality for a long period of time. And that has cost implications and other implications. So, I mean, I'll probably end up coming back a little bit to saying then maybe Francois' option D is the best one, which is to finalize this but then put something on where we just do further research to make sure we have understood this issue, bearing in mind that we set out and Martin's point is worth bearing in mind. This was intended as non-mandatory guidance, but nonetheless we set out with the objective of influencing the way materiality was being applied. And this is just one instance of the way materiality is being applied.
This stuff has not really answered to this suggestion of putting this alternate option, which is to retake the issue at a later point. Is that
so we'd publish the document now.
Publish the document now with the guidance on covenants removed, and then we'd explore a way of bringing back this into some sort of authoritative document, whether it would be some sort of perhaps IFRIC interpretation or something like that. We could look at that, and if the board wanted to go down that route, that is a feasible route to go down.
I wanted to react. I'm still thinking, given the discussion, that alternative D is a good one. But I think we should have listened very carefully to what Gary has reminded us in this document. You know, we have had suggestions that this could be authoritative guidance, and largely my understanding of this practice statement and this being set as non-authoritative guidance was to avoid conflict with potential national supplementary guidance that people have to comply with, and we cannot have the list and the inventory of all those guidances and how they could evolve and how they could generate it in the future. So my understanding of this being non-authoritative is really to give the possibility of company A or B, depending on the jurisdiction in which they are and depending on what they're subject to either limit themselves to taking this guidance into consideration or taking this guidance plus other requirements that they're subject to into account. So it's nowhere to suggest to put things in opposition. So I don't think this should lead to tensions. I think the document is written in such a way, I mean, you have a reference to national legislations. I don't know in how many examples. In my view, originally, it was just too many. Listening to this discussion, I think the staff has cut the picture right. So you don't lose from sight that you may be subject to other things. And to refine my proposal of alternative D, it's something I've never seen in the ISB do, but why not issue the materiality practice statement so that it can come into effect without these two paragraph 85 and 86, and then expose on the same day these, explaining that as part of the finalization, a question is arisen as to whether they should be, and attract comments immediately. I don't think the principles of disclosures in itself is the right channel.
I
don't believe in authoritative guidance for the reasons I've given. So I think this paragraph really believe to that practice statement. And I hope that in a point in time, audit committees will be happy to refer to the materiality practice statement, know what it is, and be happy that it is applied in their company.
I've got nothing to add to what Francois just said.
So you also want to issue the practice statement and at the same
time... No.
He wants to play golf.
Cover for long. I don't see how you could issue this as authoritative guidance, if that's the suggestion for D, because I can't see how it would ever work. I mean, would you then, if we confirmed what's in the draft, the current staff draft, would we stop somebody changing the materiality threshold? I mean, we couldn't do that.
Can't be. Yeah, can't be,
I mean,
authoritative.
It would be impossible.
I think what we could do, though, is we could have a more detailed dialogue with regulators, with auditors, with others about what our proposals are and get feedback from them. And maybe as a result of that, you may end up with regulators deciding to change to align if we went down that route, or we might end up somewhere different ourselves. It just gives us a little bit more scope to explore the issue further.
Or we just add in the two paragraphs as written into the practice statement at a later stage.
Again, we could do that if we had further sort of explorations.
So your proposal would be to take it out now and then discuss it with the regulators?
I think the proposal, well, we don't have, the staff don't have a proposal at this stage. But we do. Well, the staff do have a proposal, but we seem to be wandering away from that. And the suggestion would be that we take out what's there about the covenants at the moment, and then we either look to put it in some sort of authoritative document, or we look to have further discussions with regulators, with auditors, with others who have an interest in this, to see whether actually we want to add or make an amendment to the materiality practice statement at a later date to add something in on covenants. So that would keep the non. So if you wanted to make it non-mandatory, then we could have those additional discussions and add to the practice statement, or we could look at doing it as a mandatory guidance. As so there are various different options.
Why don't we take the vote first on the recommendations on the paper and see if we can get it.
Can we vote? Can I ask Rachel a quick question? We have had extensive discussions with regulators and auditors on the subject. What more would you discuss with them that you haven't?
So I think we should vote on what we've got.
Yeah, I think it would be a matter of saying, well, look, this is what our proposal are. What do you think about this proposal, and you know, what should we do about it? So it's a matter of, and it wouldn't be restricted just to the auditors and the regulators. It might end up being a broader consultation of people to get their views. As I said, part of the concern staff has about this is that the proposal that we have in the draft hasn't actually been exposed, and so we would feel more comfortable if we got an opportunity to have further discussions about it.
Would we want to know, though, whether this is an SEC thing or something broader than the SEC? Because as it stands at the moment, we think it's SEC and nothing further than that. Okay. That seems to me something would be useful if we go down the second step.
But it came out, in fact, all this came out of comments that we received in the balloting process. So, and it's IOSCO, in fact, referring to both the SEC guidance.
Can I just see who... supports a staff recommendation B, which is to chuck out these paragraphs.
I want to chuck out everything.
Everything.
Well, that's the second question.
Okay. The second question. So we can vote for both.
So, yes. Yes.
Seven.
Seven out of 12. Okay. And then the first question is to keep it in or chuck it also out. Yeah.
There were two question two. So the first one, I think the one we voted is to remove. Do you agree to remove the guidance on paragraph 84 and 85 plus example Q? A second question is, do you agree to retain the guidance, the other subset of the guidance on covenant? Question 2B. And then there is, well, if we retain the guidance on how to assess the materiality of information related to covenant, there is question 1, which is, do you agree to say that if the likely breach of covenant is removed, information about the covenant is not material?
So we answered question A.
2A, exactly.
Yes.
And so now 2B.
2B. So which is to retain the guidance, so you vote against Martin, I think.
2B is about the... Oh, sorry. Yes, sorry.
Yes.
Sorry.
2B.
So what was the question?
To retain the guidance.
Yeah. Having decided we're dropping the other one,
this is retaining the guidance about the how to magnitude and remoteness and all that stuff.
You vote on question one?
Not yet.
Okay. How many hands are up?
Not enough.
I don't understand why it wouldn't be more than the last one.
I don't either.
Yeah.
So I don't understand why it would be more, wouldn't it?
I'm surprised by the vote given for the votes.
That was not retained. First of all, they were removed, now it's retained.
So I would have thought everybody that voted against the first one would be voting for this.
Yeah, because at least it's part of it.
Plus a few others.
Yes. I would expect that.
The problem is it's just dangling there, without a conclusion.
What? I apologize. Can I just understand the question that I'm voting for?
So this is question 2B. So there are two parts of the materiality guidance. The first part is about the information about covenants and the materiality of information about covenants. The second part is about how a covenant, the existence of a covenant, affects your materiality assessments. We've already voted on that second part, so we've decided to take out the guidance about how materiality affects your, how covenants affect your judgments about materiality. The question is, do we also want to take out the first part of the guidance on covenants, which is about the information about the existence of the covenant?
Rachel, you just expressed it.
The other way around. The proposal is to retain that guidance. Who wants to retain
that
guidance?
Information about covenants.
Can I give a suggestion? One small, very small. The first sentence of paragraph 8.5 would be, in my view, appropriate if the vote is to retain the rest of the guidance, would be appropriate to keep in the very beginning of the session, because we don't mention what covenant is in our view in any other place. If you just take it out, no one will know.
So the covenant terms are often defined through covenant calculation.
Yeah. It's a context sentence, I think it's...
So don't...
Can be
if
retained.
We do that, your vote remains the same?
Yeah.
Okay, I think... There were not enough votes to support.
Okay, so Appendix A, paragraphs 82, 84, and example P, that's what we're voting on, right? Whether we're going to keep those paragraphs that example. Yeah? That's what we're being asked to vote on, keeping those paragraphs and that example. So can we have hands?
No.
Oh, wait, no.
We're keeping 85 and 86 and dropping 82 and 83 now, which is
the other way around.
The whole section on covenants disappears.
I think on the basis of this vote, because it was retain the guidance, if six are in favor, that implies that six are not in favor, so I think Hans gets his casting vote at six.
Well, I'm not sure I feel so strongly about it as a casting vote.
It's only a casting vote, and we are 13, apparently.
No, 12.
Then I have a casting vote, yeah.
It just feels so strong, you want to use your casting vote.
Double general European vote.
Double touch.
So that means we retain 82 to 84.
No.
This is not on covenant.
Nothing.
Oh, I thought Hans was voting to keep 82 to 84.
And change but for 85, 86, which are removed. Is that the decision?
No.
Everything. Nothing on covenant.
No, nothing on covenant.
People put up their hands for 82 to 84.
Can we re-vote again? Because I'm not sure people have understood.
Okay.
The first vote was to take out 85, 86. It's gone.
Focus.
So now we're voting to keep 82, 83, 84.
Yes, and we already decided to do so because I've
Because
you're casting vote for that.
Was this a double vote?
Those are the rules.
I have well understood.
Be very strong.
Okay. Your vote was to change
my name.
So just to clarify, on the basis of the chairman's casting vote, we're keeping guidance in paragraph 81 to 84 in example P, but we're deciding to delete 85, 86 in example Q.
Yeah, but that has nothing to do with my guessing.
The second part.
This
is a permanent deletion or a do more work?
Yep, because we just voted on the paper.
We then have one additional question, which is issue number one in the paper.
I'll go straight to the question.
What page is this?
Page 5. So since we voted to retain the first part of the covenant section, so do you agree that in this first part, the practice statement should state that on the basis of the requirement in paragraph 28 of IS 37, information about a covenant is not material if the likelihood of a breach occurring is removed? So this is the question. Do you agree on that statement?
Where would you put this? I mean, just right there in the...
It's paragraph 84.
Okay.
May I ask a question? Clarification. So before they are voting for question one, new paragraph 15, contingent liabilities, consequences of a covenant breach occurring as similar. This is the main justification of your practice statement, right?
Yes, we in drafting the guidance in paragraph 84, so we refer back to the definition of contingent liability in IS 37, and a contingent liability is a possible obligation that arises from past events and whose existence will be confirmed only by the occurrence of non-occurrence of one or more uncertain future events. So if we consider consequences of a covenant breach occurring, they arise from a past event, so the entity sign an agreement containing, including a covenant clause, and their existence will be confirmed by the occurrence of one or more uncertain future events, the breach of the covenant. So this is the basis that allows us to have this guidance in the practice statement.
Mary?
Much earlier in this discussion, Sue referred to a range of comments that we got when the draft was circulated for the editorial review. And from my recollection is that there was quite a range of comments and questions about the thing that we spent most of our time discussing here. I cannot recall, and I forgot to check, what the range of comments was like on this point. Which leads me to think that there were not as many comments about using kind of the IS 37 type analysis to determine when disclosure was necessary.
It was a couple of comments saying, well, you have this guidance in a practice statement saying that regardless of the consequence, if the likelihood of breach of occurring is removed, information about covenants is not material. What is the basis for saying that? Is it IS 37, and we actually think that the basis is our IS 37, so we confirm this in the basis for conclusion.
Okay. Subject to that, then I'll say, even though I was not supportive of keeping 81 to 84 in the example. If we are keeping it, as we are keeping 81 to 84 in the example, it seems that the information you discuss in question one should be included in there to make it more complete and understandable. So given our vote on 81 to 84, I think we should answer yes to question one.
Do we agree?
Well, that's all's well that ends well.
That's 12, aren't we?
That's 10.
10 and there's two hands down.
Okay. We thank the staff for fomenting a lively discussion.
So now it goes out.
And that concludes our meeting for today.
And then I come.